Would you tell us a little bit about the ski jumps?
Yes. Back in the 40s and 50s, we had far more snow than we now have. So the SWASA, Salisbury Winter Sports Association, was quite active. And in that era, this was run by Bill Doolittle, the headmaster of Indian Mountain School. And I was active in that. That's where I learned to ski, and I did jumping and cross country, and they had a cross country course, they may still today, that started at the bottom of the ski jump and went up over the back of the ski jump and then returned to the bottom of the hill. And I used to jump, all I can remember is the 12 and under. That was, those were the miracle years when I was raking in the trophies and the ribbons and the little silver and gold ski pins. And Tommy Atkins lived in town, would always win the ski jump, and I'd be second. Tommy did not do cross country, so I would win the cross country. And since he didn't go in both events, guess who would win the combined trophies? And the big superstar of that era was Harold Jones. His father, I think, was also Harold Jones, and worked on the town public works crew, as I recall. And Harold was known as Jonesy, and may still be today, but he was the best in cross country, bar none. He was the best in jumping, and I believe went on to the junior nationals. And in that era, we had Roy Sherwood, who was on the U.S. Olympic jumping team, and I think was certainly most active in helping raise $750,000 for the new ski jump. But what sticks in my mind is the big jump. You had three jumps side by side, a 20 meter, 40 meter, and a 60 meter. 60 meter means you can go about 200 feet with a jump. And jumps nowadays are designed where the takeoff is quite low to the knoll of the hill. So when you're in the air, you're following the contour of the hill. Back then, I would suppose the takeoff was probably about 15 feet above the knoll. So you were really thrown way out into the air. And my brother and Billy Doolittle, young, the son of William Metcalf Doolittle, he and Jimmy were going off the jump. They'd go a little bit up the in run, the takeoff, start part way up so they wouldn't go too far. And I was at the top of the knoll waiting for someone to come down the hill. And then lo and behold, I see Billy Doolittle coming in a prone position with it flat, with his skis pointing 90 degrees in the wrong direction, laughing himself silly because, you see, he chickened out and tried to Christie into a stop and went flying off the top of the takeoff and bounced off the knoll. And it was, he was more embarrassed than anything else. My brother was 13 when he was a forerunner for the, I guess they call it the Eastern Championships or something, as part of the Nationals. And he asked if he could be a forerunner, and he didn't find out until the day of the jump. So he was out until 3 o'clock doing something or other the night before. And it was either on his second or third jump, he was just plain tired. It went off takeoff and his tips dropped. And that's when the crowd gasped. I was not there, my mother was not there, but my father was. So he went headfirst down the hill, put his arm out to break the fall, and broke his wrist, and was promptly taken to the Sharon Hospital. And I gathered they had to have some kind of a rig to straighten the arm out, so my father was pulling on that to reset the bone, and I was told that he passed out.
Oh my.
I don't know if that's true, but you're talking about a Yale quarterback who was a pretty tough guy, and I...
But it was his son.
But, well... So that's what I remember about the jump.
It's pretty impressive.
And it was good fun. A very active program, and that's been pretty much supplanted by Salisbury Youth Hockey.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you had Berkshire, Salisbury, and Hotchkiss with indoor artificial rinks. And, golly, we used to go up to Salisbury School back in the 50s and have pickup hockey games on Sunday afternoons with Hop Rudd, his sons, Roz Rudd, who's a famous trombone player, Ben Rudd, who married Patty Thrall from town. Good times. It's a whole different flavor from what you have today with everybody so darn worried. And I had talked to you earlier about this. I think her name was Connie Smith, who went to Camp Sloan, and she was 10 years old, so this is early 1950s, walked into town and was never seen again. And quite traumatic for the town, and really had people starting to think, is this a safe place to be?
And it would be...
They never found her.
It would be a traumatic situation because things like that hadn't happened.
Yeah.
Here in town.
I think her parents were from Wyoming or something, and it was, it was dreadful. And we've had drownings in the lake. Those are other stories.
Yeah. And of course, there's always stories from Mount Riga.
And, did you just trigger one for me we talked about?
If you have
possibly.
One, share.
Yeah, but my brother's friends, Johnny Desmond, who is still active running Deep Lake Farm on Indian Mountain Road, John and Joel Brightman, who are tied in with the Ingersolls, Webster Newkirk, and his father, Roger Newkirk, ran the Newkirk Funeral Home by Salisbury Central School.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a wild bunch for sure. Had good fun. They'd be in bike races on Community Field. They'd be in swim races at the Grove. And going up Mount Raga Road, they some of them, you see, had driver's licenses. And so they'd take several cars up there, and then coming back down the hill, and not everyone might be familiar with the road. It's a narrow, steep, dirt road in places. And the road runs along a brook, so there could be a sharp bank in many places. They would go tooling down the road with someone between the bumpers, so on one back bumper and the front bumper of the back car. And they did daring activities of that ilk. And
and probably they never got hurt doing it.
Not that I can recall. Mm-hmm. It's just a miracle.
That's always the way.
You know?
They had a guardian angel.
Guardian angel. That's, back then we had, what, Dr. Wheeler, who was the Wheeler doctor at Hotchkiss?
Mm-hmm.
And Paul Argall cut the hair, I believe, of the boys up at Hotchkiss. This was an era when you had estates, well-to-do people who retired in the area, and if there was any emergency or campaign to raise funds for something for the public good, these things just got done quietly by passing the hat and a little arm twisting. And that era is pretty much gone. The estates are split up, and of course today people are scrambling for work.
Oh yes.
And it's very tough now to raise money.
For anything.
For anything. We've been lucky, successful so far, but that certainly is not going to get any better.
Now, the gentleman that you wanted to talk about, the lady that came to do research on him.
Ah, yes. Now I'm trying to remember her name. There was a gal in Baltimore who is doing some research on a very famous French mystery writer called Georges Simenon. S-I-M-E-N-O-N. And he lived in Arizona for a while and then, for whatever reason, moved to Lakeville in the end of, can't remember the street, but it's off of Farnham Road. And it's the Ingersoll Farm, I believe. And he, I guess, is probably the most prolific writer in modern times from France. And his son, Mark, went to Indian Mountain School. And he also went to Hotchkiss and then the Harvey School for a short time.
Yes.
I think he was asked to leave Hotchkiss for an encounter with a young lady. Things were different back then as well, I guess less forgiving for errant ways. These were in the days of George Van Sanford was the headmaster, and a nice story about him.
Oh, please.
I can remember. He was a woodsman and would take the boys out into the woods and show them how to chop wood. And I gather he took a swing and put the axe into his foot and drew blood. And as the story goes, acted as if nothing had happened. Certainly an embarrassing moment. But I remember his wife and the Christmas parties they had for the local kids in the headmaster's house, where they had these marvelous presents. And my wife is now here. Maybe we have to stop this for a moment. All right.
Let's go back and talk about the Van Sanford Christmas parties at Hotchkiss.
Right. Gala affairs, you'd give your right arm for an invitation. And so I recall she had these little toy trucks and things that were made out of metal that were beautiful things, they were works of art. And so those were great treasures. That's about it for the Christmas parties. Now I guess we go back to George Simenon.
Okay, let's go back.
Just to mention that he would walk into town every day and pass all these stores and shops that we've just been talking about.
Where did he live?
So, well, said he was off Farnham Road.
Off Farnham Road.
And, I know Nick Collin was used to live down there in the Beresdorfers, but this is going way, way back. And all I can remember about my times with Mark is that in his bedroom he kept a big black snake. And he was very much into nature. And so he would take that snake out and wrap it around my neck. And I'm not a snake person. And then he would laugh and tell me about how this particular snake likes to strangle its prey.
It was a boa. It was a boa constrictor.
No, well, it wasn't, but he pretended it was. Uh-huh. So, that was that. This reminds me. He and Judy Wagner were a number. My father was a law partner with Tom Wagner, so they had Beckett and Wagner in the middle of town where Robin Leach now has his office across from the Methodist Church.
Okay.
And we set something up. This was, my father loved gadgets, so we were one of the first to have a tape recorder. So my sister recorded our talking about our girlfriends, and she said, "Oh, I snuck in and I recorded this conversation. Mark talking about Judy Wagner and my brother Peter talking about Debbie Clark." Debbie and Judy were best buddies, and so my sister, this was all set up, you see, and she called up Judy and said, "I recorded this. You've got to listen to this." So we were filled with superlatives about how wonderful these girls were. And on it went. And I don't know what became of that, but I gather they actually were a number. And that reminds me of Webster Newkirk, because Webster and Mark were close friends, and I gather got in a bit of trouble now and then. And Sherry Newkirk, married to Webster, worked at Indian Mountain School for quite some time. And anyway, Mark was yanked back to Paris. He was a film director for a while. I think his father died, I believe, in 1989, and he died in 1998, if I remember correctly. But to put this in some context, you see, George Simenon was the Meryl Streep of our present day, of having someone in town of some notoriety. That's that. You have other questions? Steer me in a good direction.
Do you have anything else that you'd like to add?
Oh, anything else? Good heavens.
But you're limited to 15 minutes.
Why don't we hit the pause button and let's think about this.
Can you tell me something about horseback riding?
Yes, indeed. My sister loved to horseback ride, like a number of young ladies. I'll take a quick drink of water. And I horseback rode with her as well, and we'd go up to, is that Lime Rock Road, where the Minor Farm was, mm-hmm. which now intersects with, I guess, Racetrack Road, that area. And they had horseback riding shows, and it was always great to get a ribbon I don't think I ever got above a white, which was fourth place or something. And my sister did better, but there was George Minor and his wife, whose first name escapes me. But you have to remember that we were a little more respectful in those days and always addressed older people by their last names. And I guess a generation before that, best friends would address by the surname. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Jones, my best friend, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. This was also an era, while I think of it, that I think we all had rather formal relationships with our parents. They weren't your best friend. It was not much communication and not much attempt to know what was going on beyond superficial things. Now, of course, is what are you thinking, what are you feeling, and all the rest. But also active at that time, I guess, was Lucy Drummond, who later had a horse farm and her horse shows up under Mountain Road. And that farm was right next to where Carl Isaacson moved his restaurant.
Under Mountain Inn, Stone Ledge Inn.
Good for you, yes. Next to where Meryl Streep now has her lake, which I guess that belonged to the Schweikerts, was that?
Yes, it did. And it was also called Fisher Pond.
Yeah. I think that's about 63 acres, something.
Something
it's
like that.
Large. And as I recall, this, would the word be apocryphal?
No,
I won't know the word, but the intersection of Belgo Road and Millerton Road, where Lucy Drummond had her house next to our old Victorian, there are two grave markers, rather large, and as I understand it, two horses are buried there. I don't know how you would bury a horse. You'd be digging for weeks, but that's the story at any rate. And it probably is true, because it wouldn't be humans. They're unmarked markers. So we want to discuss perhaps a bit more about the lake. I remember at Rudd Camp, we would go from the camp, which was next door to the grove, across to the Hoshkes Boathouse, swimming. So you'd be accompanied by a boat, and this would be it was about half a mile across, and this would be a big deal to be able to say that you swam across the lake.
It would be.
It would be. And back then, we had a substantial raft with a diving board, and that was further out than what they now have, and I don't know what the requirements were to go out there, but that has been the scene of some tragedies of people going under the raft and getting their heads stuck between the buoys or whatever kept the raft afloat. And I remember we built our own raft that we had out on the lake with a huge diving board in it. Was such that when you went to the end of the diving board, it just about touched the water. We were 5 or 6 feet off the top of the raft, but it wasn't designed too well.
Oh, well.
That was a time when I learned to swim by they would take me out in a boat and throw me into the water.
Mm-hmm. A lot of us learned that
which
way.
Which is how I became fearful of water. Almost drowned when I was at Exeter when some kid held me under.
Oh, goodness.
And I guess we're going to wrap this up talking about
Millerton and trains.
And back then, Millerton was, I don't know how to best characterize it, but was where the poor folks lived. It was the other side of the railroad tracks, only the tracks were just on the other side, but for the record, Millerton is now the happening place.
Oh, yes.
A lot going on thanks to the Harneys, I would say. There's Harney Tea and other shops. This, at that time, the railroad ran up to Chatham, New York. So one of the stops was Millerton. And my father commuted to New York City on that train. And I always remember this Irish John, the conductor, who we'd say hello to as my father would disembark. And Phil Turney, who still has his store in the middle of town, remembers John well. I just spoke with him and he said, oh yeah, that's John so-and-so, and then he could relate when the railroad was ceased to be that far, and it now is in Wasaic. That's the end of the line, isn't it? I believe just south of Amenia.
South Amenia, yeah.
So that was the end of an era, and now we have the rail trail, and that has helped revitalize the town.
Which is a good thing.
And so, you know, we could talk for hours, but I think that brings us to the end of the tape.
And I thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.